The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 1st, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all today. Well, today I thought I'd say something about awareness. That's kind of a central issue in Zen, and maybe it's not so well understood. Might have all kinds of ideas about it that might not really be what that term is pointing to, how the awakened might use it. So I want to say a little bit about that. I can start out with a little story, something I experienced many years ago now, long before we had cell phones or the internet or any of that stuff, where we just had phones, regular phones, on landlines, which wasn't even a term then because that's all they were. Anyway, I was working, it was in an office, and I was just a young guy. But we got a new phone in the office there, and sort of like the headphone or something like that. And it had various buttons on it, and I don't remember even now how it worked. All I know is that there was one button was either red or green or off. And at some point, one of my co-workers was there with me, and then just noticed immediately at some point where, the red light was on, and then suddenly it turned green. And then he went, "Hey," he said, "it got brighter." And I said, "Well, got brighter, really?" And I wasn't thinking anything about it. I knew, but I had forgotten at that moment, that he was colorblind, red-green colorblind. And when it went from, I think it went from red to green, and when I looked carefully then after that, sure enough, the green was slightly brighter than the red. But then I realized that when I'm remembering that he was colorblind, that, oh, it's interesting because he noticed that change in the brightness, which I did notice once it was drawn to my attention. I was looking for it. But for him, that's what stood out because he couldn't see the distinction between the red and the green. For him, it was just that that button got a little brighter. And the change in the brightness, I barely noticed. Well, that was rather interesting. You know, so there's things, say, that he was picking up on that he was aware of, you know, that I wasn't, even though I'm not colorblind. I can see, I can distinguish red and green quite easily, as most of us can, I think. But there are those among us who can't make that distinction. I think it's because we're missing a particular cone in the eye that makes that distinction anyway. Is it the red? I don't know. And I asked him, well, when you're driving, the red light is always on top and green is on the bottom. So he looks for which light is on. I guess most of the time that wouldn't be so hard to distinguish, but perhaps at night or something when you're approaching it, you might not. Is that the upper or lower light, you know? But he could function with all of that. But in just kind of thinking it through, though, too, that just that little distinction there, well, not being able to make those distinctions between red and green, he lived in quite a different world than I lived in, one that I hadn't really even thought about much. And it had to do with awareness and the fact that he was aware of something, the change in the brightness, because that was so diminished over the change in the color. It was quite distinct. But if you can't see that distinction, he was aware of this other one that I was oblivious to. And I thought all of that was rather interesting. Of course, there's other kinds of blind. Well, I know that there are, I watched something on television, PBS or something, and it wasn't just about this, but it involved, there was a small group of people kind of isolated. I think they lived on an island or something like that. And they didn't have any cones in their eyes. Most of them didn't and couldn't see color. They just saw black and white. And they would be out at night, you know, and swimming there in the ocean. Those color-sighted people, they'd be lost in the dark out there. But they could see. They were calling to each other from the shore and back and forth and stuff like that. And with full awareness of that and what they were seeing. Whereas most of us would be kind of blinded by that. We want to turn some lights on or something. It was rather interesting. You think about just among people, you know, there's these kinds of distinction. We start to think about animals and how they're aware of things. Dogs, I mean, look, of course, they're down on all fours. Their noses are close to the ground. And there's all kinds of scents and smells down there that they were certainly checking out. And probably have some sense of a world that we're oblivious to. And what has gone on here, and, you know, well, that was Fido that passed by here yesterday, I could tell from, you know. And they're probably tracking things that wouldn't mean nothing to us, you know. And other creatures as well, birds. And birds can see more colors than we can. I think they have, you know, four different cones. The cones, rather than the rods, allow us to see it in the dark, and the cones help us to see color. There are a few people who can actually, they have four cones and can see, and I believe they're all women. So it must be something perhaps on the X chromosome that doesn't get blocked, you know. But only a few women, there aren't that many women that have this ability, but there are some people that do have that, and I believe they have an extra cone in their eye. And it's hard for me even to imagine, well, what do they see? You know, what do the animals, what do dogs smell? And birds and all kinds of creatures. What are they sensing? What are they aware of? And certainly, even as individuals, like my friend was aware of the change in that brightness, and I wasn't. And yet, it would seem that I was more sighted than he was because I see all three colors, you know, and the blends that they'll make. And whereas that was limited, you know, for him. And yet, he was detecting something I was oblivious to. So it's rather interesting. So we speak of awareness. The Buddha, you all know this, was once asked to sum up his teaching in a single word. And he said, awareness. Of course, when he says something like that, we're probably thinking of, okay, I should pay attention to things and what's going on around me. I should give more attention to that. And of course, in no time we can drive ourselves crazy just trying to stay tuned into everything. That's a bit much. I don't think that's what was being pointed out there. Because how can we have awareness besides that when our senses aren't even picking up on certain things that we know are sensible to other creatures? And of course, there might be all sorts of things out there that even now are totally oblivious, or it might seem that way to us, that there must be all sorts of things that we're just oblivious to. Or realities out there that we don't see or hear or taste or, you know. And awareness then would be what? That we just track the ones that we can detect, you know, the distinctions of various kinds? Or was the Buddha getting at something a little bit more subtle than that? We do speak of objectless awareness in Buddhism and in Zen, objectless awareness. And I've referred to this as our perceptual experience. It's of the perceptual, not of the conceptual. The conceptual awarenesses, these are things that we're putting together in our minds, things that we're thinking up or just building mind constructs of various kinds. We hear the sound and immediately, well, it's the bird. Well, that's a bird. Oh, that's a robin, or that's a J or whatever. And maybe we're thinking this and putting all this together, and so I should be aware of that bird sound maybe. And what, then draw the distinction? What kind of bird is it if I happen to know? Or, well, that's a one I don't think I know that call. That's new to me. So what does this mean, awareness? Awareness of what? And is it supposed to be then unlimited? Are there limits to how much I need to be aware? Well, we already know that. Well, I can't be, at least not through my senses, aware of everything. Knowing that there's other creatures or even other humans who are aware of things that I'm not aware of through my senses. And of course, with the various creatures that we have on our planet here, full of life, sensitive to all sorts of things and that even govern their way of life and living, things that they can detect and ferret out or whatever they need to be the creature that they are, or that live the life that they live. So awareness then. Well, certainly I think it is helpful to be aware or gently aware of what is taking place around us as best we can from moment to moment. But is that what the Buddha was referring to? We can so easily dismiss that, the various things that are appearing here. But we can at least, you know, try to stay tuned, be here. Maybe not just lost completely in our minds, in our thinking, in our grasping, in our trying to figure out this or that, occupied with what we're trying to get or supposed to get out of this practice. Is there something that we're supposed to get through paying attention, through awareness of this or that? Is that what the awakened are telling us about? So much of this, though, is just conceptual constructs that we grasp or we figure out or we hold in our mind. And well, but here we have, say, Dogen, who says, oh, what did he say now? I'm thinking of the Fugan Sasengi. Oh, yeah, cease from practice based on intellectual understanding. Well, that's conceptual understanding. You know, hearing words, following after speech, chasing after words, whatever. And he's saying, just cease from that. The things where it would seem like maybe we are making and using distinctions of all sorts, certainly in speaking, as I'm speaking now, using different kinds of images and, you know, words you're familiar with. You all speak English, and I hope I'm using them in some sensible order that you can kind of track what I'm saying. And of course, what it is that's going on in my mind, I can never get across to you, just as you can't to me or to others. We live in this private awareness, it would seem, that we each have. But should we expand that into other areas like this, things that we can see and touch and hear and think and grasp even, which isn't just the thinking of it, but we believe it, we think this is true, or this is how it should be, or this is what we should do, or this is how it works for me, this is the way I understand it, and see, grasping at those notions that maybe others aren't picking up on, or that the Buddha isn't expressing, because the Buddha never expressed anything like that, actually. Nor did Dogen, nor did Nagarjuna. In fact, Nagarjuna spent a great deal of effort to help us to realize that whatever is constructed there, and he's basing this on what the Buddha taught. But well, he's not just that. I'm quite convinced he sees this directly for himself. He saw this. So it isn't just that this is what the Buddha, but he attributes it to the Buddha. The Buddha first pointed this out. First or not, I don't know. But the Buddha pointed this out. So we pay attention to this, but it is about, well, awareness and just saying, but it isn't about figuring something out. that it will be just a conceptual construct. Helpful for you, perhaps. Might be a hindrance for you as well. Be careful there. Look at it carefully. But that's it. It's the looking, the seeing, the just seeing, the just looking. It's not the thinking that comes later, the conceptualizing, the trying to make something of this. This is delusion, pointed out by the Buddha, Nagarjuna Katagiri Roshi. I've mentioned that many times, the story. We're in a talk one evening, and he says, whatever you think. He was looking at this or that, and you know, and he says, whatever you think. He says, that's delusion. I kind of got it pretty soon because I realized how serious he was on that point. But it was, we all just kind of laughed. It was almost kind of dismissed, sort of funny. Yeah, well, this is just delusion, yeah. No, it is all delusion. Nagarjuna points this out, that the various things that we hold or grasp, the different kinds of theories, even the teachings, the Four Noble Truths, the skandhas or the aggregates, and is pointing out all of this. In his invitation, chapter after chapter in his book, the Mulambajamaka Karika, which, by the way, now I'm working on doing a book on this. There's been so many done. I thought, what's the point? But I realize there's stuff here that's not being touched on enough. And so I'm going to make this effort now. I am making it. But anyway, but there's so many things in there that, well, what Nagarjuna was doing was just showing that the various constructs and the things that we've put together, even in the teachings of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, and Eightfold Path is the fourth noble truth, but also, like I said, the skandhas and the dharmas and dharma theory and all of this sort of stuff. He takes all of this apart. It was after that influence of Nagarjuna, well, even a little before as well, where we have things like the Heart Sutra, and we speak of the no eyes, no ears, no nose, no suffering, no arising of the Four Noble Truths, with nose in front of them. The Diamond Sutra, which says that any bodhisattva who's a true bodhisattva is not a bodhisattva. What's the object there? But this is the logic of, it's not Aristotelian logic. We might think, well, then it's not accurate. No, Aristotelian logic works perfectly well in this world of constructed ideas and thoughts and imagery in the mind and that sort of thing. Helps us to be consistent and to avoid contradictions and that sort of thing. It doesn't help with the full perceptual experience, which includes the conceptual as well. It's a different kind of logic. The logic of the Diamond Sutra is A is not A, therefore we have A. Whatever A is just a substitute for anything you want to put there. Whether real or imagined or any way you want to look, whether it's a physical thing, a thought, a feeling, an emotion, an expression, anything you want to put there. A is not A. If we actually have something there, it's not that. A is not A. Therefore, A. That's how we have this. And this awareness that the Buddha spoke of, I would say that this isn't, yes, we should pay attention to the awarenesses of the various items and things that come across our path during the day, physical and mental and thoughts, whatever, emotions. Pay attention to all of this, give some awareness. But this is conceptual awareness that we can give to these things. These things all appear to come and go. They appear to persist for a time. And we're completely caught up with that. And for most of us, that's it. That's reality. That's the whole of it. No. And this objectless awareness takes us, I don't know what to say. I don't want to say outside of it or whatever, because words start to fail. And this is our pure perceptual experience of reality, the world, from moment to moment. There is nothing there for you to grasp. That would be to take hold of it as an idea, a thought, a concept, a belief, or a structure of some sort, whether it's physically or material out there, or a mental construct of purely just relationships and ideas, whatever it might be. And to take hold of these things, and all that stuff is very functional and useful. Well, maybe might not all be useful. Some of it could be detrimental in various ways. But that doesn't mean that we should never go there or use ideas. Or I couldn't give this talk without making use of that realm there, the conceptual and the graspable. But if we remain limited to that, and then we interpret what the Buddha and what Nagarjuna and Wangpo and Dogen and others have pointed out, that these things that seem so inscrutable because we can't easily grasp, what do they mean by that? What are they saying? You just sit there with it. Don't think about it. You're not going to figure it out. That doesn't mean you're not going to understand it. What you can do is to discover that you already do understand it. If basically you would just kind of shut up. We do understand and know reality. In fact, it is all we know. It is impossible to know something that's not reality. But as we see the various objects and things like this, and we grasp this or that, and this is what Katagiri was saying, whatever you think, whatever you take hold of here, that's delusion. So this isn't the Buddha way. It's not about believing something or taking hold or making it, interpreting it in your own terms. This all works for me. It doesn't work. This isn't working. This isn't about working for anyone. It's just working right now, reality. Don't apply, drop the word working, though. Because anything you put to it, then we grasp. And as Katagiri was pointing out that night, whatever you take hold of there, that's delusion. You don't have to grip it. We think, but I do. I got to get the idea of this, otherwise I won't understand. No. You will understand if you drop that. Doesn't mean that it isn't important or it has its function and use in some place. Be aware of that. Yeah, then tune in as well as you can to that, the conceptual. But there is this, I've been saying, objectless awareness. Pure awareness, it's sometimes called. This is what I, in my writings, and in my talks too, I make the distinction, I've applied the word percept, or perceptual to that, as opposed to the conceptual. Because the conceptual, whether it's a physical object or otherwise an idea, whatever, it'll take on a form. It'll seem to have boundaries. It will have appeared to have come into existence that is persisting now, and then it'll pass. Everything that is of that nature has those characteristics, and others as well. They can be contradictory, they can work together, any number of things there. And that's where most of us are, with what the awakened are inviting us to do with this objectless awareness, is realize that that's not the whole thing. And you will never wake up if you continue to grasp or to hold or to believe. A lot of people think that maybe Buddhism is some kind of a belief system. No. Well, the Buddha's teaching is, this is what the Buddha thought. This is his opinion. No, if that's all this is, was just like everything else. Oh, it'll have a different story, a different slant. But it's of the same constructed nature. And this teaching, this practice is about helping us to wake up to the fact that this reality, if we really want to understand it, is not about grasping anything in any way. It is about, well, I've said, I'm not the only one, but just seeing. It's a term is used a lot, but just seeing, the just meaning, and I would italicize both of them if I was printing that out, because it isn't ordinary seeing where we're seeing an object, seeing an idea, I get it, I see what you mean. But it's not seeing like that. This just seeing, because that's seeing and then thinking, getting ideas for it. Oh, we can use this over here. But yeah, again, that might be functional and useful. It's not wrong or bad. But this is something else. If you want to wake up to reality, it's not of that nature. If you're holding something there, if you think all these years I've been teaching has been trying to get you to grasp something, believe this or take hold of that, that's never it. Well, sometimes I might fumble and do something like that. On the whole, I'm trying to just help you notice what you're experiencing directly. Because that's where the true knowledge is. And you do have this knowledge because you are having a direct experience of reality all the time. It's impossible to be without that. But it isn't in what you take hold of. It isn't in what you grasp. It isn't in what you think. Scott Agari said, whatever you think is delusion. I would say it's delusion if you believe it. We can think things and know, well, that's not really true. I could think about unicorns and, you know, without believing that unicorns exist. Of course, I wouldn't say that I know that unicorns do not exist. What would that even mean? See, that's the other thing, when you get into the conceptual, well, you start debating and having all kinds of arguments and, you know, for and against that. Yeah, I mean, like unicorn, how can you say they don't exist? When I said unicorn, I'm sure you all had some kind of an image in your mind about what I was saying. You know, so does that exist then? Yeah. Well, they're not the same, though. They're not, you know, and we can argue and argue and argue forever and never settle that little debate there. That's how it is in the conceptual world. And that's why Katagiri was saying, whatever you grasp, whatever you take hold, well, this is how it is then. Or you should believe this, or look at this over here. You don't need to do these sorts of things. Not if your interest is in waking up to what's actually going on. Because what's actually going on cannot be grasped. And as Norm says, it's unpin-downable. You can't pin it down. You can't put it into words. And it's no more mysterious than I've given the example of the tasting of the orange juice. You can't tell somebody else, get it across to them, the taste of orange juice by telling them about it. Even if it's a beautiful description, a vivid description, the only way to taste orange juice is in the tasting of orange juice. It's the direct perceptual. You try to construct any part of that to explain it now to others, or, you know, it'll never be it. But if you believe the various things that you might offer back to people in explaining this or that, yeah, well, that's what the awakened would say, that's delusion, yeah. Of course, when we hear delusion, we think, well, look, so that's bad. No, the awakened don't tell us delusion is bad, but see if you can realize its nature, the nature of delusion. And part of what I've been trying to point to this morning is of this sort. Again, don't go applying something to it. Now, that's a constructive thing, like, oh, but that's bad, that's a negative thing. And the Buddha doesn't approve of that. Well, where's that idea coming from? You know, we do this all the time, and we immediately patch on all these things to what our thinking is. We're not even realizing that we've done that, and we walk around with that, and now, in any given moment, we can pull any number of those things back out and use it in our argument or speech about this or that. Yeah, we don't do that with everything all the time, but it's there in our minds, and we act out of that. But then we have this human-constructed world, which right now we're doing such work to it that we have to start wondering if we're going to make it on this planet. I just heard some more news about that. I won't scare you with it, but it was rather shocking about the way the Earth is going in terms of the overall environment. But I'll let that go. But it is something we can wake up to. But even there, I wouldn't panic too much, because those are still constructed ideas. The reality as being lived is immediate, and that's always the case, and it cannot be otherwise. So I wouldn't worry about it too much. Because the things you will worry about and be troubled by are the constructed things. That includes things like, well, here I am, that's a constructed thing, and I will die. A couple days ago, we interned my brother's ashes, you know, and there's my brother, and I touched the box of his ashes, my heart goes out that he was my brother. I loved him. Known him since I was born, I guess, because he was a little bit older than me. But to make something of it and to go somewhere with it, well, that's going to happen to me now, too. I'm only a couple years behind him. I'll be turning 80 soon. So how much longer? I'm just hoping I can finish this book now I'm working on. But we could start to worry and fret about things like this. But we can know something more than that or beyond that. Those kinds of words don't work here. But there's something else. And we just... This is something I told Katagiri when I was 32, and that's the first cancer I discovered I had. I've had several major cancers now in my life. But and that one, it was a non-Hodgkin's, stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And in those days, you you couldn't cure them. I don't know. But obviously, I'm still here. But I remember telling Katagiri, I realized, because I had learned this already at that point, and I said, I just have to put one foot in front of the other and just keep walking. I could imagine things like, well, I'm going to die pretty soon. Yeah, the odds are, it looked like, But that was, 47 years ago now or something like that. And I'm still here. You know, and I've had other major cancers since. I've had lung cancer. They've removed part of my lung. I'm still here. But anyway. So don't think about these things. Just put one foot in front of the other. Take care of this moment. Don't ignore all of that. I didn't ignore the world of cancer and that I had cancer. And the possibility was there. It's come to me several times where I could die from this. I know I'm going to die at some point. We all are, you know. But that's an idea. Is that really encapsulating and grasping what's actually going on here? Well, if we look long enough, and it's just looking, just seeing, just hearing, just tasting, but just look, and you read what the awakened have said, if you can find those kinds of teachings, because they're blended in with a lot of teachings that aren't written by people who really understand. In our own teachings, I mean. But the stuff is there. But just for all of it, though, just look at it. Don't make too much of it. The things that are actually pointing to reality itself will sing out eventually if you just keep coming back and if you don't think about it. If you think about it, you'll start manufacturing something yourself, and that'll be delusion. Just come back to the kinds of teachings that we have. At some point, you start to see that, well, this teaching, that's confused, isn't it? That's sort of ordinary, grasping kind of teaching again. There's others, like with Nagarjuna, you can't get to the bottom of it. People ask, I taught those courses on Nagarjuna, you know, what's his point? What's he got? Because you show that if you do this or you do that, this doesn't hold up. Okay, so what's his point? Can't exactly say that he had a point other than he was just pointing these things out. But okay, so we're going to get the right one, right? If you just keep doing this with Nagarjuna and what he's doing, you might give up on that idea that we're going to get the right one here. He certainly didn't lay it out for you. He points out how the Buddha didn't either. Right there in the Mulamajambaka Karika, if you read it very carefully. And this is how it is with the awakened. They're not handing us anything. And whatever it is that you take hold of, because they use words. I use words. People take hold of things that I've said. What, really? And I might have to say, well, that's not quite what I was pointing out. Oh, yeah, but you said that. Yeah, yeah, okay, maybe I did. But so just be careful with it all. You don't need to grasp. That's why Suzuki Roshi said in Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, there it is in print. You know, when my talk is over, your listening is over. No need to remember what I said. The need is that we pay attention to this moment. And most of all, which is the least likely place we're going to look, is just watch your own mind. Look at what's going on right here. It's in your grasping. It's also, and look at, there's a desire in there. Yeah, because I want to know. I want to get hold of something here. Yeah, I understand. I have those feelings too. They don't go anywhere with me now, but they certainly did. And never had to start asking myself, well, do I just want to get a handle on something, or do I want to wake up? Yeah, well, getting a handle on something, you feel like you've got something. Yeah, but that's never it. And I started to understand that. Well, the thing then that I want, I mean, what it? I was clueless. Still am. If I had something to tell you there, I'd tell you exactly what to do. Do this, and pay attention to that, and you'll wake up. You can't do that. Just watch your own mind. Watch the grasping. This is what you need to do. It's not a matter of you getting something. You already have it, so to speak. There's a lot of things wrong with that statement, but any statement we make, there's a lot of things wrong with it. But I'm just kind of trying to point there a little bit. But you know the truth. It's not removed from you. It's what's being directly experienced by you all the time. It's a matter of, well, just as Nagarjuna says, and title of each chapter of his book, his masterpiece, the Mula Majjhima Karika. It's pariksa in Sanskrit. Examination. All 27 chapters. He doesn't end with chapter 27 being, this is it. This is examination. Maybe by that time, there what he was examining pretty carefully was a lot of the kinds of arguments that were being tossed about in the Buddhist communities at the time. With much of that, and also the way he just goes about doing this, is very helpful for us even today. And a lot of these kinds of questions that were debated then are still debatable now. Well, anyway. So, objectless awareness. This is when the Buddha was speaking of awareness. Yeah, of course, awareness. Pay attention to your surroundings and what you're doing in the immediacy of this and that. Take care of these things. Why should we do that, though? Well, it kind of keeps things settled. And that helps. That's why we set up the Zendo in the way we do. You know, and the chairs and the cushions are placed in just such a way that the Dohans should know how to do this. And you just kind of leave them set there. You can maybe modify, you know, cushion to it or whatever, if you need to. But then when you're done, put it back right where you found it. You don't adjust the windows or something for you. You're in a community here. The Dohans, there's one person, the Dohan or the Doshi, the person who sits here. Doesn't have to be a guy. But the person who sits here or the person that sits over there, they can adjust windows and move chairs and seats and whatever. But you don't. This is giving up your ego. You know, Katagiri Roshi, I remember one time too, where we got this kind of a larger bell. I wish we had one like that. Yeah, well, wish, I don't know. But it would be nice. But it was a bell about so big, and you hit it with a stick in a particular way. And it was Dohans at the time, and I was still kind of new to all this, but we were kind of tilting. Somebody noticed if you tilted the bell, you can get a better sound out of it by tilting the bell. Katagiri Roshi came downstairs and he saw us there and he saw that bell. He went immediately over to the bell and he leveled it. And then he said, you adjust to the bell. You don't make the bell adjust to you. This is Zen. And here in the Zendo, we're making a community. You can't just do this anyway. We all just kind of wander in, sit in whatever chair, do, you know, fluff it in different ways or make a lot of commotion. This would not be a meditation hall. It's the way we step into the room. Yeah, we even don't have to prescribe all the way down to which foot you use. Yeah, and I always tell people at the beginning, don't worry about which foot, but, you know, we step in with the left foot and you exit with the right foot. But don't worry about that too much. Just be aware of what foot you're stepping in with. And we walk in a certain way. And that's why, because you're composing the whole space, the room, you're part of that whole composition of it. And it's in that where we can find the settledness we want to settle down into in our practice. It has nothing to do with your ego or doing it your way. Well, it always works better for me if I don't know, think of the various things you might want to do, but are disruptive. And if we were all doing such things. But this is Zen. And it isn't like that's wrong or bad, you're evil or stupid or whatever, you know. But if we start to learn what this practice is, it's all kind of geared for just, let's see if can we come together and then settle down for a period of time and just pay careful attention to our minds. You know? And then bell rings, somebody's keeping track of that. You don't need to keep track of that. And we get up and walk out in a certain way, dropping your ego. You know? You'll still walk in your, like I used to watch Katagiri Roshi, the way he'd enter a room. And that's how I would enter the room then. I'd just do what he did. But he was only a little over 5 feet, you know. I'm 6 feet and just a lot bigger. And I realized that, well, I can't actually do what he does. I'm a bigger person. I have a different body. Yeah. So, but I could see the kind of the basis of what he's doing, what he's acting out of, you know, how he steps in. I can step in with that. I just follow that. And it will be my own natural expression because it's this body, which isn't like any other body, just as your body isn't like any other body. It'll be your own expression. But you don't have to add to that then your intent. Well, I like it like this, or I don't want to step that way. Or just drop that stuff. And then we can find this mind, this settled down mind, which maybe will just look. Just see and not add something else to it. Like, I should use this then to do that. And drop that altogether. Once in a while, it's time to use it. Like when you're maybe cooking a dinner or baking a cake or something. Think, okay, I just saw her and also made me think of this. Cake you did. But now follow the recipe. And of course, yeah, you can tweak the recipe and things like that, you know, and either for your taste or maybe for somebody else that you might be baking this for or whatever. That's all fine. But on the whole, just kind of watch that and, you know, to the extent you're starting to impose now on others and their practice, or just be aware of these things and see if you can back off a little bit back toward what would be more subtle. That's all this is, really. Learn to do this over and over. And at some point, we can see what is given, what is right there, and not be involving ourselves with a lot of made-up stuff that keeps us confused, keeps the world disturbed, all of that. Well, I better stop. I've gone way beyond the time restriction here. But anyway, any questions or comments or anything? People on Zoom or? Yeah, Matt.
You know, you were talking about at the end of you enter a Zendo and you don't make a commotion. Mm-hmm. You people that shop at the Linden Hills Co-op.
Oh, yeah.
And I watched the cashier. It's usually a very experienced cashier. We'll scan the item and kind of gently place it there.
Yeah.
And someone who's a new cashier will just kind of toss the groceries up there.
Yeah.
And it never affected me. Now I'm very hypersensitive to this.
Yeah.
And that's what I noticed. Like before Zen, treat other people nicely, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to treat the insentient beings with the same kind of care.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's not just in the Zendo. You see a good cashier, they do it naturally. And it's a joy to see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.